We're joined in the studio now by Tom Martins. He's a career Foreign Service officer who served in the White House as National Security Council Director for Nonproliferation and Homeland Security in the Clinton and Bush administrations. And he is going to be presenting a lecture next week at Higher Ed called Terrorism 2012, The Nature of the Threat. Hi, Tom.
Good to be here.
Thank you for being here today. Well, first of all, what does serving as National Security Director for Nonproliferation and Homeland Security entail?
Right. Well, the National Security Council coordinates foreign policy. And so you try and be the fair broker in the middle, making sure that all the agencies get to express their opinion and that the final decision memo that goes forward that you write contains the views and the reasoning behind those views. So, for example, one of the decision memos that I wrote was on the India-Pakistan nuclear issue. And I didn't know much about it when I started, but by the time I got done, I did. And, you know, the participants on both sides thought that I represented their views. Of course, you know, the decision by the president can go against one agency or another. You never know in advance. He's got a lot of equity he's got to take into account.
So. Mm-hmm. So nonproliferation refers to weapons or nuclear weapons in particular? Or?
It refers to particularly weapons of mass destruction and the means to make them. So, for example, we spent a lot of time trying to keep track of nuclear material. It wasn't necessarily in the form of a nuclear bomb, but, for example, spent fuel rods from a reactor contain uranium-235 if you separate it out using chemical processes. And so there are pools all around the country of these hot spent fuel rods, and you want to keep them under control so that nobody makes off with those rods and, you know, does something with them to make a nuclear weapon or even a dirty bomb, which is essentially something that will make a Geiger counter vibrate, but it may not hurt you. Mostly it's a weapon of mass disruption because people hear the word nuclear and they get scared.
Sure. So. Well, this sounds like one of those jobs that must keep you awake at night.
Well, when you work in the White House, there's not a lot of margin for error. They have some very specific views, and they don't always tell you what those views are, but if you misrepresent them, they don't like it. And so, you know, when you have a change of administrations, like between Clinton and Bush, the new administration frequently does not have their policies settled and in place. So a lot of the agencies, like the Department of Defense and so forth, will call over and say, well, what's the policy on this subject? And, you know, you may not know because there may not be a policy. So then you make it up. Oh, did I say that?
You did.
So, yeah, what you do is you say, well, from what I've heard, this looks to be the direction they're going. But, you know, I wouldn't make any decisions. And sometimes you can tell the agencies, you know, it's probably safe to do this, but I wouldn't do that. So don't assume that there's going to be a decision in your favor. Assume that there be some continuity, usually. And this is what may happen down the road. You can probably do this without getting in trouble, but you probably can't do that. But, you know, it's like I say, I could have gotten in a lot worse trouble.
So, yeah, I'm sure. I saw in the background we got from Higher Ed that in your Forest Service career, you worked in many different places across the world.
Right.
How did that, you know, how did that inform what you did at the White House?
Well, it all kind of builds one on the other. And, for example, what I did in the White House also informed what I did working on counterterrorism. So in the White House, my principal portfolio was nuclear issues. Previous to that, I was the high poobah at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow for environment, science, and technology, officially the minister counselor for EST. So that job included two really big sub-portfolios, supervising a Department of Energy program to try and contain these weapons of mass destruction and the means to make them. That was $300 million a year. And the NASA manned space joint program with Russia. So those were, okay, if you supervise NASA, you're going to learn something about space. You better learn something about space. And if you're going to oversee the Department of Energy, and they were, you know, trying to, you know, secure Russian nuclear materials all over the country, you better learn something about nukes.
Sure.
So, you know, I took time off to go to a couple of the nuclear laboratories. There are a couple of them in, there are actually three of them right now that are principally nuclear laboratories, Los Alamos, Sandia, and Lawrence Livermore. Two of them are in New Mexico, one in California. And then Oak Ridge in Tennessee still does some nuclear stuff. But mm-hmm. So you go there and you take a couple of week course and you learn, you know, how to make a nuclear weapon.
Wow.
Something okay. Everybody should know, right?
Right. So you mentioned working in counterterrorism. You were deputy coordinator for counterterrorism when 9/11 happened.
That's correct.
What was that like?
Well, the first thing is that I had just come over from the NSC staff, the White House. So I didn't know much about counterterrorism. The second thing is the two lead agencies for the U.S. government for counterterrorism are the FBI domestically and the State Department internationally. So here we've got the lead on an international terrorist event. I had been there 2 weeks, still learning the ropes. After the event, my boss went off to Brussels to brief the NATO allies, and I was left in charge. And, you know, I was pretty well lost. Good thing they didn't hit us again there. You know, I'm making it up as I go.
How have you seen the terrorism threat changed since that time, Tom?
Well, the big event, of course, involved Al-Qaeda, and the two embassy bombings in Africa in 1998 involved Al-Qaeda. The USS Cole in 2000 was Al-Qaeda. And they've become now a franchise operation where people use their name to raise money and to attract recruits. And then usually they have to do something to justify what they're claiming they are. And so they, you know, kidnap somebody or blow up a bomb here or there. But Al-Qaeda Central, let's call it, the one with bin Laden and Zawahiri, that is less important and less effective, in part because bin Laden is dead. But even so, he spent 5 years back there, I mean, communicating by courier. He wasn't exactly, you know, right on the cutting edge of planning and carrying out terrorist attacks. So there's less of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but there are so many other organizations that kind of imitate Al-Qaeda. And so we'll have trouble with those. Our biggest problem right now is the Afghanistan one. And we have close to 100,000 troops there. We spend $100 billion a year. And so people know the former director of the CIA, Leon Panetta, said that there may be 50 to 100 Al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. That was a year ago. So there aren't very many Al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan, but we still got all these troops. Mm-hmm. And so what's happened is the classic mission creep, as it's called. You know, we went in there, and I actually helped plan the event to get rid of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And we had given the Taliban and Mullah Omar an ultimatum, which, in fact, I helped draft. You know, you got whatever it was, 48 hours to turn him over, and, you know, we won't bomb you. Of course, we didn't get a response. But so that was why we went in there. And then what happened is we mostly chased Al-Qaeda out, but we ended up taking on the Taliban. Well, the Taliban are Afghan. And so here we are kind of in the middle of a civil war. And the Taliban are going to play a role in the future governance of Afghanistan, no matter what we think, no matter what we do. And so now we've been there 11 years. Things are not appreciably different than when we first, immediately after we went in there, we chased the Taliban out very fast using the Northern Alliance. But then bin Laden escaped from Tora Bora. And slowly we took up a mission of getting rid of the Taliban. And that hasn't worked at all. Al-Qaeda is still mostly out of Afghanistan. So the question is, what are we doing there now? And after 11 years, we still have a problem. And my view is we could stay 11 more years, and the outcome would not be appreciably different. It would just mean more money gone, more troops killed, wounded. So, mm-hmm. And part of our problem is the Pakistanis are supporters of the Taliban and of the Haqqani network, and several other of these, you know, Lashkar-e-Taiba, which conducted the Mumbai terrorist attack 4 or 5 years ago, and several other things, you know, five-star hotel attack, embassies, and so on. And so we've got the Pakistanis, who are allegedly our allies, playing a double game, and it's all because of India. They lost 3 ground wars to India. They believe that they need defense in depth. That means if the Indians were to attack them, they would want to retreat into Afghanistan, because the tribal affiliation is very similar, and they you know, so they've been supporting the Taliban all these years, and at the same time they're taking our money. They do conduct a few operations against extremists that they think is in their interest too, but they don't go for the big guys. They sacrifice a few of the, you know, the cannon fodder down below. And the idea that they didn't know for 5 years that bin Laden was there near their military academy, that one's hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impossible, but almost impossible.
Pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Tom Martins. He served in the White House as National Security Council Director for Nonproliferation and Homeland Security in the Clinton and Bush administrations, and he's giving a lecture at Cook County Higher Education next Wednesday, September 5th, from 5 to 7 p.m. on Terrorism 2012, The Nature of the Threat. Well, Tom, you mentioned that, you know, you think that what we're doing in Afghanistan isn't working. Where do you think the U.S. should focus its efforts in preventing further terrorism?
The two important things, or let's say three things. First is intelligence collection. And it's very hard to penetrate some of these extremist groups. We don't do it very well. But point two is cooperation with foreign intelligence services. And we have liaison with over 100 intelligence services around the world. Some of them are very good. And in the 5 or 6 months after 9/11, we broke up a half a dozen plots overseas, Philippines, Malaysia, Italy, France, and so on. And it was Jordan. It was all because of the local the National Intelligence Service of those countries. Sometimes we give them a tip, sometimes they give us a tip. So intelligence, and including intelligence cooperation. The other really important thing is law enforcement. Most of this is a law enforcement problem, not a military problem, because you go in and you start dropping bombs on people and you invade their country. The one thing that people know about Afghanistan is they don't like foreign invaders. Nobody's had very good luck invading Afghanistan. And so here we are with 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, and that, in fact, undermines Karzai, the president. You know, he looks like he's a puppet. So sometimes he reacts and he tries to, you know, maintain his independence, and with good reason. So that's the way I see things going. So it's intelligence collection, intelligence cooperation, law enforcement, and as many international partners as you can get to work with you.
Mm-hmm. Now, we only have about 15 or 20 minutes with you tonight, but your lecture next week is going to be a full 2 hours. Can you give us a little preview of what you'll be talking about?
Sure. I have been teaching terrorism courses the last couple of years, and I worked as a consultant to the State Department for a couple of years in terrorism. And so it's my take on the problem and how you address it and reasons why they hate us. There are a number of ways to address that question, depending who's telling it. And, of course, the people who are attacking us think they have really good reasons to attack us. And some of them are religious, and some of them are nationalistic, and so forth. But the question is, what should we do about it? And I've given you some of my thoughts, but I could go on at some length, as I've been wont to do.
Well, and I understand that you're retired now, and you and Jim Boyd went fishing today.
We're not talking about that. The only thing I'll say is that he was catching fish on a lure that I gave him a couple years ago.
And he wouldn't share?
Wouldn't give it back.
Yeah. That's terrible.
Andy, I wonder if I could just ask a question.
Of course.
You mentioned earlier that when you were at the National Security Council, you worked with weapons of mass destruction. We don't hear so much about the debate, but of course, for a long time we did. We went into Iraq, supposedly, for weapons of mass destruction, which we never found. No. Were you involved with that discussion? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but were you involved in that
discussion? No, I wasn't. The single most time-consuming portfolio, as they call it, that I had was the Iranian nuclear program, mm-hmm. but I also followed the Iraqi nuclear program. And the question was, how good was the circumstantial evidence that we had? And it turned out not to be very good at all. And there was a high degree of ideology involved. And my view was that, remember, Israel attacked the Osirak reactor in 1981, the Iraqi reactor, and took it out. And Saddam did have a nuclear program at some time in the past. And so there were people in our government who were worried that Iraq had moved its nuclear program underground and could still threaten Israel and maybe others, Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And so they believed that an underground nuclear program, like Iran now has, was immune to air attack, and the only way to be sure there was not a nuclear program was to invade. And so now you see, by the way, just a repeat of the same story about Iran. They're close to having a nuclear weapon, and they're going to threaten us, and so on. The Iraqis were never a threat to us. Terrorism, perhaps, in the Middle East. The Iranians could not threaten us militarily. We have the second largest nuclear arsenal in the world. We deterred the Soviet Union, when they had 5,000 or more missiles. The Iranians could not, assuming they are rational and can be deterred, they cannot threaten us. And that's what people like to say, is they're irrational, they're ready to commit suicide. As soon as they build one nuclear weapon, they'll do something with it. And then, of course, a lot of things will rain down on them. So, these are things that people argue about, and there's no definitive answer, but if they're not rational, they cannot be deterred, right? Mm. Now, you've seen several leaders, Israeli leaders, say they are rational. I mean, they mobilize their population by citing some threat, or the U.S. is doing this, or Israel does that, and so forth. That's part mobilization. You see political parties do that. So that's kind of what I'll be talking about.
Great. Well, and that talk is next Wednesday, September 5th, from 5 to 7 p.m. And if you want to register, you can call Higher Ed at 387-3411, or you can email them at higher ed@northshorecampus.org. Do you want to add anything, Tom?
No, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. Very fascinating, and we look forward to your lecture.